Excuse me, this is the operator. I just need to inform parties that the call is now being recorded.
Welcome to everyone who's called in for this meeting of the Recommendation 6 Community Working Group. This is Chuck Gomes speaking right now. I will ask Glenn to do a just to identify the ones who are on the call, and then we'll see if anybody is missed in that roll call. Glenn, go ahead.
Thank you, Chuck. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is the community work group call on the 7th of September. On the call, we have Siva Subramian from the at-large, Stuart Lawley, individual, Konstantinos Chromatis, non-commercial stakeholder group, Frank Marsh, GAC representative of New Zealand, Avery Doria, non-commercial stakeholder group, Chuck Gomes, who is a co-chair from the registry stakeholder group, Mark Cavell, GAC representative from the UK, Leanne Wan, a GAC representative from China, please correct me if that's wrong, Krista Papak, a registrar representative, Richard Tindall, individual, Jamie Wagner from the ISP, Olivier Crépin-Leblanc from the at-large ALAC, David Kisson-Doyel from the at-large, Maximilio Miniski, who is the GAC liaison staff person, Robin Gross, non-commercial stakeholder group, Marilyn Cade is the chair of the business constituency, and Bertrand de la Chapelle from the GAC, representative of France. Thank you, Chuck. Over to you and for staff. Sorry, we have Marika Konix and Glenda Saint-Jacques, myself, and of course also Massimilio Miniski that I said. Thank you, Chuck.
Thank you, Glenn. Just one correction. I think this is September 6th, not September 7th.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry, well, you'll have a chance to say the 7th tomorrow, I think. So,
yes,
so we have that. Thank you. Thank you very much, Glenn. I appreciate it. And welcome to everyone for calling in. Special thanks to those of you calling in from in the evening hours and early morning hours, as well as those calling in from the U.S. where it's a holiday. Appreciate that very much. Our first agenda item is the to talk a little bit about the poll results. Now, please don't make more out of the poll than what it is. I think a couple people did that, and it was just a tool used to help guide our work this week, because we may not be able to cover all 14 of the threads that were previously identified. So this gives us a little bit of a feel for how we can prioritize things and get what most of the people think are most important done if we don't have time for all of them. So, Glenn, would you please give us a summary of the results? And just before you do that, all that people were asked to do was to identify their top six threads out of the 14. That's all. Nothing more than that, just so that we can kind of see from that some sort of a trend. And I think it came out fairly useful, and we'll talk a little bit about that after Glenn does a summary of the results.
Thank you, Chuck. I will start by saying that there are 58 subscribers to the list.
Okay, thank you.
That does not, that excludes the staff on the list. And there were 27 respondents to the poll, 18 of which came from the GNSO, 4 from the GAC, 4 from at large, and there's one unidentified person. Now, the thread that got the highest number of votes, 24, was the use of morality and public order terms. The next thread that got 20 votes was international principles of law. The next thread that also got 20 votes was high board threshold for approving, rejecting recommendation 6, the DRSP decisions. And the third category that got 19 votes is strings only. After that comes category 4 that got 17 votes, which is outsourcing of dispute resolution process. Category 5 that got 11 votes, universal availability, objective with limited exceptions, as well as the category that got 11 votes, standing for filing objections, and then the 6 that got 9 votes, guidebook criteria number 4, 7 that got 7 votes, use of the term incitement, the 8 that got 6 votes, quick look procedure, 9th that got 3 votes is independent objector, and also timing of recommendation 6 dispute resolution.
Glenn, did you skip the International Center of Expertise, or did I just miss it?
The International Center, I don't think we've got that on, Chuck. Just let me see where that came.
Right after quick look.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yes, it was skipped. That got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And it was skipped. It was in the, yes, the International Center of Expertise of the ICC and DRSP. You're quite right, Chuck. Thank you. And then after that comes the 9th category 2, 3 votes. Independent objector, and the last category with 1 vote was incitement to discrimination criterion. Now, of the respondents, there were 3 from the registrar stakeholder group, 2 from the registry stakeholder group, 4 from the non-commercial stakeholder group, and 4 from the commercial stakeholder group, and 5 who are classified as individuals. And then, as I've said, 4 GAC participants, 4 at large, and the 1 unidentified person. Any other any questions?
Any questions on Glenn's summary? Please raise your hand in the Adobe Connect room if you can. Do we have anybody on the call this time that is unable to participate via the Adobe Connect room?
Chuck, I'm not on Adobe. It's Marilyn.
Okay, so Marilyn, when you know what to do, just verbally let me know when you want to get in, and I'll fit you in there. Thanks for letting me know. Okay. Did you have something to say, Marilyn? Okay.
The beep. Thank you.
I didn't hear all of that. You were breaking up.
Never mind.
Okay, thanks. Sorry. All right, going on then. Actually, I was pretty pleased with the results in such short notice, and it's a pretty good spread, pretty broad participation. Obviously, there's a lot more GNSO participants than any other one group. If you break it down by stakeholder groups in the GNSO, it spreads out a little bit more, but I think we had some from every major SO or AC, which I was really happy about. So my intent would be to just start with the morality and public order terms and how we deal with those in our report first, because it almost received unanimous support for being a high priority, and then work our way down the list in terms of importance. Does anybody have a problem with that? Just raise your hand. Okay? Everybody's okay with that? Well, then, rather than taking a lot of time analyzing the poll, which it wasn't intended to be that precise, let's start talking about the use of the terms morality and public order and how our report, which is due in a week, would deal with that. Now, we made clear in previous meetings, or I made clear in previous meetings, that the use of the terms in Recommendation 6 are not going to be changed. But that does not mean in the implementation portion the use of the terms can't be changed. And so what I'd like to throw open right now is what suggestions do people on the call have for adjusting the use of those terms in the implementation plan in Applicant Guidebook Version 4? And just raise your hand if you'd like to make a suggestion or have a question or a comment in that regard. While people are thinking, I believe it's accurate to say that, thanks for the hands, I believe it's accurate to say that the use of those terms anywhere where it implies that there are any international standards related to those would not be acceptable. But I'll now let others jump in. Frank, why don't you start, please?
Thanks, Chuck. Just to reiterate, I think what I suggested once before, that changing the term at this stage, given that it's embedded so deeply into all the documentation, would, I think, be cause more confusion than clarification. So what I would suggest is we simply redefine the term to mean sensitivities or whatever agreed terminology you can have, but remove any reference to international legal norms and leave it at that. I think that would be the easiest way to deal with the term. Thanks.
So just to try and recapture that, make sure that we all heard it accurately, first of all, and I'm taking your second one first, remove any references to international law related to morality and public order. If any of those statements exist, that needs to be fixed. And then secondly, define the terms morality and public order. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's my suggestion. And we've had several suggestions for how that might be done. Yeah.
Can you go ahead and share those if you're willing?
Well, I think there were comments came from various people talking about sensitivities of various types, I don't have the wording in front of me, but I know that there have been other suggestions that have been made by various people, and I'm sure we can find some way of doing it other than referring to international law. That's really all I'm saying.
Okay, all right. That's very good, and I do recall discussion on the list that there were several that had some concerns with the use of the term sensitivities, but we'll get to that as we move down the line. Bertrand.
Hi, I wanted to link maybe the following Frank's remark, the two first columns, because we're addressing two issues, as he mentioned, the expression international principles of morality and public order, which is clearly a problem for GAC reasons. And so when we deal with the second column, it would probably be useful to keep international principles of law, which do exist, and to remove international principles of whatever formulation of morality and public order, which do not exist. Now, the second question we're addressing in the first column is the term morality and public order terms. Richard will probably repeat it, but I noticed with interest his comment on the list saying we could use a formulation that is just other objections. I believe it is maybe going a little bit too far in terms of generality. Sensitivities is something we can explore, but in a sub-element. I was wondering whether we couldn't use, as I raised before, the expression public interest objections and try to define what they are.
Interesting idea. Thank you. Richard, go ahead.
To Rich, Bertrand just noted for the group, if people hadn't seen what I wrote, that I just proposed that we could do away with the term completely and just call it other objections, but just wanted to bring that to people's attention to think about. But I'm actually quite comfortable with the notion that Bertrand just put on the table, which is public interest objections.
And public interest objections would replace what in the implementation plan?
In that case, the title, which is currently morality and public order objections.
Oh, okay. Okay. Go ahead.
We would decide how it is. It is used because the thing is, morality and public order, as the GAC has discussed at length, is something that can be used potentially by a national government as an exception, and this connects with the other column later on, which is universal availability objective and limited exceptions. Morality and public order could probably remain somewhere as an exception that some governments could raise at the national level to block a TLD that has been accepted in the general global route.
So if I understood you correctly there, Bertrand...
There are exceptions.
Yeah, so morality and public order objections could still be a subset of the public interest objection category, is that right?
No, this is not exactly what I meant, is that this could be used or limited to national measures, just like in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, where Article 29 says there can be limitations to freedom of expression or freedom of association and so on at the national level by national law for public order and morality reasons. So when we come to that later, whatever the regime we adopt at the global level, there could be a paragraph that would satisfy, I believe, most GAC members that maintains that governments can, under specific circumstances, take measures at the national level regarding accessibility or availability of a TLD that is in the route.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for clarifying. That's why I wanted to make sure that I had it right in my own head. Richard.
Yeah, this is Richard again. So I just wanted to clarify and see if people are thinking about this the same way that I am. In my mind, when we talk about this specific issue, in my mind we're talking about it in two contexts. The term morality and public order as it fits in whatever standard we're coming up with. And in my thinking, that's something that we want to remove from the standard. We want to remove those words from the actual standard that we create. The second context that I'm thinking about this is as the overall description of this objection in the DAG. And that was the more to the point earlier where I was saying I don't think that adds value. I don't think it's an accurate term. And I was proposing some more simple term like other objections. Bertrand has put on the table public interest objections, and I think that probably works even better. So, again, thinking about this in two contexts. One, the use of this term as an overall description of this objection. I think we need something kind of bland, more bland there, if you like. And then specifically with respect to the standard that we create, I think that the term morality and public order is not accurately, not encompassing enough, and we should remove it from that.
So do you find the term public interest objections too bland?
I think that's beautifully bland.
Oh, it's beautifully bland. Okay, good. No, that's fine. That answers my question. Are there other comments on this? And while you're thinking, Marika, are you? Let me know at any. Are you capturing the ideas for us?
This is Marika. Yes, Chuck.
Thanks. I was sure you were, but I just wanted to confirm for everybody else. And certainly, Marika, if you have if anything's not clear, stop us so that we make sure that you get what you need, okay?
Okay.
Thanks. All right. Now, okay, this is, I think, these are constructive inputs. Does anybody that's on the call have any objections to the suggestions made by Bertrand and Richard in this regard? So we'd be talking about a category. Oh, go ahead, Marianna. I'll let you go, and then I'll say what I was going to say.
All right. Thanks, Chuck. Hi, everyone. I like where this is going, I guess. I think certainly I wanted to support Richard's distinction between what we call it and what the standard is. The concern with saying public interest objections, as Richard and others were saying, it really is bland. It's kind of broad. I'm not sure it adds that much clarity. So one suggestion I had was, if we don't reach, or maybe we ought not to reach a resolution on what we're going to call it or what the term's going to be until we've had a chance to discuss the standard or standards, and that might give us some clarity on what the overall title ought to be.
Okay, thank you. And I think the standards will come in when we get to Category 4 of the four categories that are in there right now. Which is one of the threads that we have on this thing. So thanks, Mary. I think that's helpful. Robin, go ahead.
Thanks. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Yeah, I have a problem with calling just this sort of catch-all public interest objections. That's extremely broad. It's far more broad, in my view, than morality and public order, which at least tries to focus on a couple specific public interest objectives. So I've got a huge problem with calling it public interest objective. Plus, I think it's not objective. I think we need to stick with having this rooted somewhere in international law. We have to remember that we have to come up with a test that is objective, and rooting this, grounding this in international law and those kinds of objections gives us some kind of objectivity, gives us some kind of guidance to go on. So I think we don't want to move away from grounding this in international law. And I'm also concerned with broadening this up to more to just public interest, this fuzzy term in general, because I feel like that will have significant impact on Principle G, which guarantees freedom of expression. So I think we want to be careful that we don't undo existing principles and existing recommendations, which would, in fact, be outside of our mandate anyways. So that's all I wanted to say on that. Thanks.
Thanks, Robin. A couple questions for you to make sure that we're all on the same page. I don't think I heard anybody say moving away from principles of international law. I think the concern is that there's no international law specifically related to morality and public order. Now, the second thing is that, and I think maybe you hit on something, and I'm not even sure this was your point, but instead of calling this category public interest objectives, I think what we're really talking about, and Bertrand, correct me if I'm wrong, is public interest objections. In other words, objections that are put forward to a string that are based on some to be defined and have to be defined principles of public interest.
Chuck, it's Marilyn. Can I get in the queue?
Sure. Bertrand's in there first, and then you're in, Marilyn.
Right.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Bertrand.
This is an answer to, or an attempt at an answer to Robin for the very valid questions that she's raising. I put a comment in that respect in the chat. There are two points. The first point is that the expression public interest has a benefit, in my view. I may be wrong, but I sense that it has a benefit of forcing every objector to present its objections towards a string by making the argument in terms of the public interest, and in particular in terms of the global public interest, because what is requested is not entering something in the root. So a government or another type of actor could make an objection saying there's a national public interest here, but there is also a challenge about whether it has a global public interest dimension. And I think it would also fit with the general responsibility of ICANN, as mentioned in the IOC. The second element is, and here Robin is absolutely right, public interest objections would be only the title, and the discussion we need to have is how the grounds for such public interest objections could be described in more detail or in a more precise way, so as not to make it a catch-all category. So I think Robin is right, and in particular, you remember that in, again, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, there is a last paragraph, I think, that basically reminds that any limitation or any provision in the Charter, in the Declaration, that allows for restriction should not limit in any way the universal validity of the principles in general. And maybe we could think of reaffirming in connection with Recommendation G those principles in the same paragraph. I hope it helps.
Thank you, Bertrand. And I think that's consistent with what Richard was saying earlier. And my recommendation is that we don't spend a whole lot of time talking about the title. And the more difficult and the more important aspects are the criteria for evaluating whether we have a global public interest involved or whatever. So let's go on. Marilyn, you're next.
Thanks, Chuck. You know, I know we keep saying that there's no specific international law, but I did post to the list quite an extensive list of the various, the core UN treaties related to human rights, elimination of violence against women, International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment or Punishment, Convention on the Rights of Migrant Workers, Convention on the Elimination of Forms of Discrimination Against Women, etc., Convention on the Rights of the Child. There are a number of core UN treaties that, in fact, do address rights and freedoms. And
Go ahead.
Nothing. I just wanted to make sure that we take note of those existing relevant treaties.
Okay. Now, Marilyn, a question for you. Do you think, would you recommend those treaties being considered to be added to the references that is in the implementation plan in addition to documents that are already included?
I think so. I think that if the majority... But, you know, I should just say one other thing. I was clear in my comments that I think there has to be an expert panel of some considerable standing. If the objection being raised were a technical one, then the board would certainly be seeking outside technical advice. And my view is that the board has to be able to rely on independent and highly qualified experts, and it takes expertise to interpret treaties or international agreements.
Thank you. Cheryl, thanks for confirming your agreement with that. Let me ask everyone on the call, is there anyone on the call who would object to a recommendation going forward suggesting that these other that serious consideration be given to adding these other international treaties that Marilyn has listed as references with regard to the implementation of Recommendation 6, in particular, the dispute resolution process in that regard. Anybody object to that?
Chuck?
Yeah, go ahead, Bertrand.
I do not object. I just want to say that it's very important in whatever reference is being made to explicit text that it doesn't seem to imply that those who are not quoted are not relevant. And in particular, there are some international principles of law that are not necessarily codified, but that can be used and are really general principles of international law. And so any formulation and any explicit quoting of text should in any case have a formulation like such as Treaty A, Treaty B, and so on in a non-inclusive list or something of the sort.
Okay, thank you. Marilyn, did you have any response to that?
No, I think that's actually one of
that I would make, and that is that not all, depending on the objection, not all of these court treaties would be applicable. It would depend on what the nature of the objection is.
But the whoever the dispute resolution providers are, they could make a decision in their expert opinion as to and cite particular elements from these treaties if they were applicable.
Right. So let me just say that, you know, I think it probably goes without saying, but I'm going to say it because maybe it doesn't. The process, the administrative process of operating a dispute resolution procedure is an administrative process. So I favor the independent dispute resolution provider identifying and maintaining a identified group of experts that are brought into an applicable into a panel, depending what the nature of the objection is, rather than thinking that it is the dispute resolution provider themselves who are actually acting as that expert panel.
And I think, if I'm following correctly, that that's very consistent with the GNSO recommendations in that there really was not an expectation, or at least we hope that it wouldn't happen this way, that you have a dispute resolution panel of experts that voices their opinion whether something violates Recommendation 6 or not. But hopefully they can make a judgment based on, and this comes back to what Robin was saying and what Bertrand confirmed, based on some international treaties or whatever that can be cited to back up their expert opinion. So it adds more objectivity to the process, I think. Let's go on to Constantino.
Yes, hello, everyone. Just one very small point. I would like to reiterate what Bertrand said, and in principle I agree with Marilyn that we need to provide examples of treaties, but this list or whatever list we intend to provide should not be at any means exhaustive. International law has more things than treaties, like, for example, customary international law, which plays a very, very important role. So we need to leave whatever panel there is to make determinations based on their own knowledge and their own expertise on international law. We can provide guidance, but I would be very concerned if we were to provide, and apologies if I haven't understood that correctly, an exhaustive list of those treaties that we consider relevant for these purposes. Thank you.
And I think your point's very well taken. I don't think, I'm not sure we have time, or even if we had time, we could provide an all-inclusive list of possible documents, but we could certainly include a list of possible documents that may be relevant, and that shouldn't exclude, in my opinion, the experts themselves in bringing in their own knowledge of treaties and so forth. So I think that's consistent with what your intent is it not, Marilyn?
Yes. Yes, it certainly is. I wholeheartedly agree.
Thank you. Let's go to Richard.
Yeah, and so just quickly, I agree with all of that. And just wanted to point out that the current DAG, I think, kind of does recognize the things that we're saying. It uses terms like, when it talks about these treaties, it uses terms like, for example, but not limited to. So it opens the door for other ones that it hasn't listed. Does, of course, talk about sort of generally accepted principles. So, it's addressing the scenario where perhaps some countries have not signed on to the treaty. So I think the current DAG language is kind of broad enough to think we're talking about now.
Okay, thanks. Now, what I'd like to ask Marika to do for me, if you would, I haven't heard any objections to this direction suggested by Marilyn on the list and then on this call today, but we need to reach out to those that are on the call. So, Marika, could you put out a possible recommendation that would go in the report that with regard to the dispute resolution process, that the documents listed by Maryland could also be possible documents that could be used by the experts, but that it's not intended to be in an all-inclusive list, or that they apply in every case. You can probably word that a lot better than I just did, but if you could put that out to the list and just state that, as far as we could tell on this call today, there were no objections to making that recommendation, but that we'd like to find out from the rest of the group participants whether there are any objections, and if so, to please explain. Okay?
Yes, okay.
So, thank you very much. Now, so are there any other issues we need to deal with regard to the use of the terms morality and public order? And we've actually gotten right into the second priority, which is the international principles of law. We'll cover that a little bit more. But anything else on the terms morality and public order? And I think the recommendation, and I guess, Marika, we should put this out to the list as well, as it stands right now, is, and we can still discuss it on this call, is that there would be this category called public interest objections, just a title, nothing more. The criteria for evaluating that would still have to be developed, and that we would remove all morality and public order references to the extent that they try to define a standard that the experts would use. Did I express that well? Anybody want to express that better? So we should also, I guess, Marika, what we need to do is make a list of the various things, the recommendations that are coming out of this call, and then ask those who weren't on the call, or even those who are on the call, if you have additional thoughts, to if they have objections, to state so, or if they have improvements. Okay.
Then we had the question, Chuck. Would you like those to go out in one single email, or would you like to create?
I think probably. Otherwise, we're going to have. I think that's probably okay, considering our short time frame. Unless you think differently.
No,
does that
fine.
Sound okay to you? Okay. Okay.
Yep.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Let's go on to the second priority then, which is. International principles of law. Is there more we need to talk about that? Now, we talked in a previous meeting about the fact that I think staff in their documents in with regard to applicant guidebook version 3 have made it clear that, you know, they're not claiming that there's an international law out there with regard to morality and public order, but there are some commonalities across various jurisdictions. So, does anybody have a problem with that application of the recommendation that the GNSO Council made? Okay. Is there anything else with regard to international principles of law that anyone thinks we should talk about today? Please raise your hand if you do.
Hi, Chuck. It's Evan.
Go ahead, Evan.
Hi. Sorry, I'm not on Adobe Connect, and I just joined the call recently. Things in Labor Day are a little weird here. Regarding, I think the difficulty is, given that there is, not any specific treaty or, not anything specific, that unless it can sort of be enumerated what those common things are, it becomes difficult to even talk about this issue in the sense that, if they're international principles, okay, let's be a little bit clearer, at least in the public face of things, about what we're talking about. There's a lot of speculation and a lot of fear that I've seen on this issue from people that are thinking that, well, this could be the lowest common denominator of simply that which is not objectionable to everybody. And at the other extreme is sort of, well, It has to be that very small subset of things on which everyone agrees, with very few exceptions, are universally abominable. Can we make some clarification on, you know, that we're clearly on one side of this?
Well, Evan, let me ask you a question. Don't you think staff has done that in the documents that they have presented already? Don't you think that the first three categories, I'm not talking about the fourth one now, but the first three categories do exactly what you're saying? They have found common elements and identified those across, I think, what is it, eight jurisdictions or something like that. Go ahead and respond.
Oh, well, I'm just saying that as a matter of a public and transparent face to what we're doing, we ought to be very, very clear about this. I don't know. I'm just saying that's what I've seen come across other channels is there's been an awful lot of fear, and has been said in the email, you could interpret a certain, you can even interpret the GAC email as saying, well, it has to be things that are simply not offensive. I think we just need to make sure that, from what we're saying, that we need to simplify that clearly what side of this thing we're on.
And I think that's what the GNSO intended as well, is that there should be objective standards to measure these things. And all I'm saying is I guess I'm challenging you, if you don't think the first three categories meet what you're just suggesting and we need to improve those, then we should work on that. But I have the impression that with a few things that we've got to work on, like the use of the word incitement and things like that, it does identify some specific things that would fall into a categories of possible of viable objections.
Okay. I don't want to impede things further. I mean, I've sort of said my piece, but you're right. We need to move on and clarify things in the context of everything you're talking about.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Thanks. Okay. Bertrand.
Yeah. Thank you. And I apologize in advance for saying something that some people may not like, but I think it has to be aired. We're dealing here with two different types of objections. One category I think we have covered more or less with modifications of wording, which are the words or the strings that would be in a certain way universally objectionable, like there are really superior principles that make them really truly offensive. And we can discuss how precise we are, what kind of reference documents we make, but it's the notion that there are global principles. But there is a second category that I think the GAC wanted to highlight, and I know it is not very pleasant to hear, but there are situations where a national government, for instance, or several of them, will express concerns regarding a string because of their national framework. And being able to handle these doesn't mean that we consider, as we said before, that any objection should block a string. But I give you, for instance, a very concrete example. If you have an applicant from in one country that does a string that is really offensive to a very specific subset of this country, a community, or there is a very strong hatred between two groups within a country, the country itself will feel very concerned, and there will be a strong sensitivity, to take the GAC wording, regarding the idea that this specific applicant from that country will go to the global route and do something that is really going to cause major legal problems in the country. I do not have the solution, but I think it is very important that the procedure allows in one way or the other the government in that case to raise its concern. What the solution to handle this concern is, we have to discuss. But I think the procedure should deal not only with things that are globally objectionable to evaluate whether they are or not, but also to find a mechanism that guarantees and ensures for to get the support from most governments that there is a way for them in such cases to voice their concern. Whether they are taken into account, whether nonetheless the string goes in, is a second issue. But we should not forget that this problem is going to arise, and to convey not the position of the GAC, but the sensitivity of the GAC members, I think it's important that we have this in mind.
Well said, Bertrand. I think that's important information. Now, a question for you. Am I correct in assuming that those kind of objections, regardless of how whether they are it's agreed to prevent a string or not, would come under the public interest objection category?
Yes, it could, because, for instance, let's say I take a hypothetical situation, but I remember something a representative, I think in the IGF, a representative of an Asian country, and it was not China, I think it was Indonesia, but I may not be sure, said, and it was not only about TLDs, it was at the lower level regarding restrictions to freedom of expression and so on. What do you do as a global, as a national government in terms of ensuring the security of your citizens if there is a purposefully offensive proposal that is dealing with a subgroup in your country that can lead to real social unrest, that can lead to even riots or murder, not against the government, but among different communities? There are some cases where things are very sensitive. And I know it is a very delicate subject because you can veer or err very quickly in towards the notion of preventing blasphemy and things like that. I understand the danger. But I think it is a case where it is a responsibility of the national government to try to at least raise a flag. How the flag is being handled afterwards is another issue. But it is a national public interest issue. And one of the challenges that ICANN, as a global manager of the global root server system, has to face is that there has to be a balance regarding the global public interest and the national public interest in that case.
Now, and follow up to that, and Mary, you're next, so hang in there just a second. But is there anybody on this call that thinks that an individual government should not be able to raise an objection along the lines that Bertrand is talking about here? Now, I'm not saying that they should have veto power. Please don't go there. That's not what I'm saying. Is there anybody, though, that would disagree with what I think Bertrand is saying, that an individual government that has a concern in this way should not be able to at least file an objection in that regard? And you can either speak up or raise your hand if you do object to that. I would think that we would all support that, but I don't want to assume that without asking, and that's why I'm doing that. So, okay.
Chuck,
Evan? Yes. Go ahead, Evan.
Okay. I think one of the things that may be a very significant transition that we're making here is the acknowledgement that not every single objection has to lead to a massive yes-no process that leads to either utter rejection or utter ignorance of the objection. And this sort of follows up from Bertrand's answer to my proposal that I sent on the email list, which was extremely useful to me in framing this and thinking that, you know, perhaps in addition to, you know, there's certain objections that have to be listened to as, you know, being a go, no-go thing. But perhaps, you know, to use Bertrand's wording, maybe we're over-engineering some of this, that maybe some of this is simply a matter of making sure that there is a way of getting the objections put in front of the applicant so that they are absolutely aware of what they're about to do. That may or may not lead to a complex adjudication process, but at least offers a way that for governments and maybe others to make sure those objections have a proper proper and open channel.
Thank you. That makes sense to me. Let's go to Mary.
Thanks, Chuck. And actually, I'm going to change what I'm going to say and follow up on what others are saying. And this was something that I've been thinking about after reading Evan's proposal and Richard's proposal. And to answer your question first, at least for me, when I look at the DAG, clearly when you say anyone has standing to object, that's got to include national governments. Maybe it's not explicit enough. I'm not sure that it should be. But as Evan also said, the distinction here is what happens. And what I've been trying to figure out and trying to, you know, put it in a particular way to send by email, but I'll just try and say it orally on the call, is if we look at some of the proposals that have been made, whether it's Evans or Richards or Anthony, it's maybe whoever raises the objection, and let's use the example of national governments here, national government could say, I object to this string because it contravenes a particular, you know, well-known custom or something like that, or my national law. As was said, this doesn't necessarily make it an international legal norm. So what I was trying to figure out in my own head is whether or not if we keep the standing to object pretty broad, it includes national governments who could object on the basis of national law or custom, but that in terms of the dispute process or whatever we want to call it, that there is some kind of international expert that determines whether this raises an issue of public international law. And if it doesn't, then if the national government, then they can do whatever it is that they want to block the string or so forth. But if it does not amount to a contravention of public international law, that's as far as it goes. And if it does, in an expert opinion, amount to an issue under public international law, then it could go into the full-blown dispute resolution process. I don't know if this makes sense to anybody, but this was kind of the idea I was working out over the weekend.
Well, actually, Mary, again, as chair, I'm going to co-chair, venture my opinion. I think that's consistent with what the GNSO intended. I think that hopefully the dispute resolution process, whatever that looks like in the end, would do exactly what you're saying. I didn't find anything. I thought you articulated it very well, so I think that's very good. Olivier.
Thank you, Chuck. I'm just a little concerned about this, the idea that we might be over-engineering things a little bit. When I hear Bertrand say that he believes some countries should be able to object to a string because they think it will cause serious trouble in the country itself, or might cause serious trouble in the country itself, I believe that that country, in any case, is going to block that name, whether it's allowed or whether it's not allowed. And here we are trying to think of dispute resolution mechanisms and turning our heads around and so on. And ultimately, issues of national sovereignty, such as those, are probably and most probably going to be just taken up by those countries, no matter what ICANN does or not. That's all I wanted to mention on that. Thank you.
Olivia, a question. What do you think is being over-engineered? I don't understand what's being over-engineered, because what you described, several others I have heard say as well.
Well, we're looking at ways, we're looking at trying to find out whether we should allow specific terms, such as terms like Bertrand mentioned, or other terms which might be derogatory. Or now, of course, some terms will not be terms of national objection as such, but the terms which are of national objections, which I think that we're trying to define, we're just wasting time on at the moment. That's all.
Okay, and right now I don't think the intent is to talk about specific terms, but rather a higher level of the process. But okay, thanks. Thank you. I appreciate that, Alan.
I just wanted to go on a little on something I just put on the chat regarding what Evan said, that the concept of a list or something which alerts an applicant to the fact that something may be objectionable presumes that everyone is honorable, and once they realize that, they may decide to take action on it. And I think the reality is that we may see cases where people deliberately put things because they are inflammatory or to prove the point. And we need to grapple with, are we interested in trying to fix to address that, or is that something not of any concern to us? But I think we have to recognize that not everyone is going to be going into this with the same motives.
Okay. Thanks, Alan. Appreciate that. Let me ask a question of others on this particular issue, and I guess it's more, does anybody object to adding to our list of possible recommendations out of this meeting a statement that would say that I think this is helpful maybe for GAC members, for individual governments, to say that they are they can, in the existing process, they are able to file an objection based on a national concern. We can't guarantee how that will come out in the process, but I think that possibility is already there. I know that the GNSO in its recommendations specifically intended governments and the GAC to have standing. So I think that already exists, but I also think that it might be helpful to state it to make sure that it's clear, and I think that's consistent with several people's comments in that regard. Anybody object to that being adding that to our list for people that are not on the call to weigh in on? Okay, so Marika, that's another one. So, okay, going on then to the anything else on international principles of law? Okay, going on then to, forgive me if there's a little bit of background noise here. I'm in a public area. That's the only place I can get connectivity. So I will do my best here. If I need to move outside, I will. Okay?
Hey, Chuck, all right. It's Mary.
Yes, Mary.
Hey,
I see your hand up. Sorry. I was,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was scrambling to raise my hand. Sorry. No, just quickly to note that in whatever statement or recommendation we came up with, to reiterate a point I've made before, that we are consistent in our usage. And I would ask the group to think about whether if we're going to use something along the lines of international principles of law, whether we mean international principles of law or principles of international law, which is the one I'm suggesting. But in either case, it has to be consistent.
Now, which one are you suggesting, Mary?
I'm suggesting that we should use, to the extent we use any phraseology along these lines, that it would say principles of international law. I can't offhand recall exactly what the GNSO wording was, but maybe we could use that as well. But, you know, A, it has to be consistent, and B, I think we should make it clear that we're talking about international law here in some sense.
So I'm still not clear on what you think the best formulation is.
You're differentiating international principles of law from principles of international law, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And which one do you prefer?
I would say principles of international law, although I think the more important point is consistency internally and consistency with what the GNSO intended.
Yeah, the point's well said on consistency, so I'm with you there. So, but does anyone disagree with using the term principles of international law? Anybody see any problems with that?
Chuck, it's Mark Covell from UK. I'm sorry, I've had no luck actually accessing Adobe Connect. Virgin Media, for some reason, is denying me that. Can I just, I don't know why, but can I just go back one step. I mean, with the reference to international law, is this going to cover the range of sensitivities that this whole process is aiming to address? I mean, I take the point about achieving some sense of universality of problem strings, that it's not, we may not be dealing with the objection from a single entity, but some broader scope of this process, so that we're not going to deal with every possible objection or every possible sensitivity. But my question is, when we talk about principles of international law, are we actually binding ourselves in some way because we know it may not be catching the full range of sensitivities, the kind of sensitivities which the GAC identified in its principles on new GTLDs. I'm sorry if I'm going back over territory you may have discussed before or that's been covered online, but that this is nagging me, this pursuit of a framework of international law.
Actually, I think that's right along the line I was asking for comments on, so I think that's very appropriate. Now, what I'm wondering, though, is I wonder, and maybe Marika can help me on this, although she hasn't been as closely involved as Margie and Liz have been, and they're not on the call, whether we could maybe raise that issue, and the one that Mary's suggesting, the difference in terminology, with the attorney from Jones Day, who's going to be on the call tomorrow. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So let's please, would you please, both Mary and Mark, would you please, I hope you can be on that call, and would you please raise questions in that regard with that expert? Now, the way that's going to happen tomorrow, there's going to be a brief presentation, and then there will be a Q&A. And even if this isn't exactly in the topic of the presentation, I still think it might be helpful to raise it during the Q&A period. So I would like to ask you to do that. Now, Cheryl, would you take over the call for a couple minutes? I'm going to go on mute and move outside under the pine trees where I think there will be less noise, okay? And I think I can get my connectivity up there.
Be my pleasure, but of course the background noise isn't problematic. I think Chuck's being oversensitive about his holiday status there. I certainly wasn't getting any noise. But yeah,
is anybody hearing the noise? If not, I'll just stay where I'm at.
No, look, you're comfortable staying here. While you've given me the microphone, Mr. Co-Chair, one of the things just with the Q&A point you were making, and to Mark, it would be very useful, I think, tomorrow if any questions with notice could come into a list, or if anyone wasn't able to join the call, we could ensure that the questions were read to the record by those of us chairing it and that they were responded to. Even if you can't be physically on the call, I think your questions can be raised.
Okay, Mark speaking. Yeah, I'll have. Is the call at the same time?
No, it's earlier. I think it's earlier. 3 hours earlier.
Right. I'll still be in the office then. I should be able to join the call. Okay, thank you.
Good. And Glenn, you're gonna send out the call information on the call for tomorrow, right?
Absolutely, Chuck.
I just kind of I knew you were, but I wanted everybody else to hear it. So. Okay, going then, that's great. And Richard, you're next in the queue. Marika, before I turn it over to Richard, could you please, in addition to this list of possible recommendations coming out of this meeting today, could you also then add in the message a request and a notice that anybody that's unable to make the call, if they have questions, that they'd like to be asked, to the extent that they're on subject, we will try and get them asked for them. Okay?
Okay.
All right. Going on then to Richard.
Yeah, thanks, Chuck. Who was the speaker just before you a minute or two ago, Chuck? Who was that?
Mark? Are you talking about Mark or Mary?
Mark
from the UK?
But yeah, Mark, I'm from the UK representative on the GAC.
Right. Thanks, Mark. Yeah, I just wanted to reinforce what Mark said, because I think that really is the central issue to my mind in front of this group. I think all of the topics here are important, but to me that's kind of the central issue. And let me see if I understand it correctly. I think what I'm hearing is that there are potentially strings that are going to be sort of profoundly objectionable, or whatever word we want to use there, but that nevertheless don't reach the bar of being sort of contrary to international legal norms. I think that's the issue on the table, that there are potentially strings that don't breach these international norms, but nevertheless would be offensive, profoundly offensive, objection, whatever term we want to use there. And I think that's the central issue that we've got to find a solution to.
Yes, that Mark speaking. Yes, that is the point I'm making.
Okay. Thanks, Richard. And I think you're right. And some of that's going to get into the actual criteria that whoever makes the decision will have to apply with regard to an objection that is made. Anything else on principles of international? Principles of international law. Did I say it your way, Mary? I'm not sure. So we'll get that straight. And I do agree we should be consistent. Not seeing any hands or. Yeah, you're welcome. No, this is very valuable stuff. Let's go on then to this the third thread, and actually tied with international principles of law, I think, with regard to the high board threshold for approving or rejecting dispute decisions with regard to a particular string in the process. Now, to get discussion started on this, let's jump to a conclusion and then ask if it's a fair conclusion. It seems to me that there's very strong support in this working group that there should be a high threshold. We'll talk about how high at another point, but a high threshold for the board to either approve or reject. And I know some people have suggested one way or the other. We'll get to that too. But is there agreement in this group, or is there any disagreement in the idea that there should be a high threshold in that regard, understanding that we've still got to define some of the details? Is there anybody that disagrees with that on this call? Okay, hand up, Aubrey. Oh, I'm sorry, you disagree, Aubrey. Okay, all right. Okay, and I'm going to call on you in a minute, Aubrey. Bertrand, go ahead.
Yeah, it's not really to disagree, but to link this issue, this third column, with the other column, which is outsourcing of dispute resolution process. If you remember, the expression outsourcing, I think, came from Frank, if I'm not mistaken, last time, and I think the discussion evolved in the direction of saying, there is some unease in the group regarding the notion that the whatever panel is being constituted is the final decision maker. And I think we all agreed that there is a final responsibility or ultimate responsibility for the board, even if it is useful to have expert advice. So it is in this balance that the notion of a high threshold in the board emerge, whether it is to support or to object, but if there is a responsibility, a special responsibility ultimately for the board, it is clear that there would be a benefit in having a really clear majority in the board regarding whatever decision is being made. I think the two are connected, and this is a direct consequence of the thing that we tend to go in the direction of giving the ultimate responsibility to the board.
Okay. Thank you, Bertrand. Aubrey.
Okay, mute off. Okay, the reason I couldn't agree with the board statement that was said basically we need high thresholds no matter what is I believe there should be incredibly high threshold for disapproving a name in the notion that anything that is universally offensive
should be able to get a high threshold. But if we start talking about approvals, then I do not believe that needs to be high. I believe that, you know, majority approving something as having, you know, gone through the proper process, et cetera, is you know, what it should be. So that's why I couldn't agree with a statement that said high in either case. Thank you.
No, thanks, Aubrey. That leads in a direction we need to go. So, and I'm sorry for starting off in too general an area, but Aubrey, I believe, and correct me, Aubrey, if I'm wrong, is suggesting, and others have done this on the list, that there should be a very high threshold, whatever that is, for rejecting a string based on recommendation 6. We're not talking about other recommendations and new GTLDs, just recommendation 6. Are there those on the call who think there should be a higher threshold just for approving a string that has an related to recommendation 6? I see Bertrand's hand up. Go ahead, Bertrand.
Yeah, I'd like to explain a little bit more what I mean by raising the topic of approval. Imagine a situation where there is a string that is of concern to a significant number of actors. It can be governments, it can be other communities, and so on. Whatever panel of experts is making an evaluation, saying, for instance, this is not contrary to international principles of law in general. However, there is a significant number of concerns that are documented in this way and that way. This report goes to the board without a recommendation that says frank yes or frank no. Likewise, at the same time, the GAC, because a certain number of governments are concerned significantly about a given string, is sending an advice that is neither a full no or a full yes. That says, as it happens times, we have different positions within the GAC. A large number of GAC governments do not see a major problem or even not, and significant GAC members have raised concerns as documented in XYZ. I think in that case, we should not forbid the situation where the board would ultimately, in the global public interest, say, all well considered, we believe that the pros outweigh the cons. We know that there will be a certain number of countries where the string is being blocked. However, generally speaking, we see no reason to refuse, and we decide to enter this spring into the route, knowing that some countries will block it, there will be objections by different kinds of actors. In that case, I think it would be good, maybe it's a different threshold, but that there is a significant answer within the board regarding the general interest of overcoming the objections. So it may seem strange, but for people who care about having sensitive strings in the root, the situation may be that we need something that has a strong legitimacy where the board takes the decision in conscience to say, we know there are objections. There are split positions in the world regarding this string, but all well considered, we, at a large majority, believe that it is not sufficient to not put them in the root. So I want to make the case, and maybe the thresholds are slightly different, but I think a little bit more than the majority, the single majority, would be beneficial to increase the legitimacy. And once again, it's a different situation. It may be a different situation in terms of requirement, depending on what the recommendation of the panel or the position of other actors or ALAC or the GAC in terms of advice. If everybody says we strongly object, then it makes sense even for the board to take a non-approval at a simple majority. If there are actors who say, I mean, if there is no absolute objection by the DRSP or by the GAC, and the board wants to not put it into the route, it makes sense to have a strong majority. And if there is a split recommendation by the DRSP or the GAC or ALAC, and the board wants to put it nonetheless, I think it makes sense to allow the board to have a significant majority that would show that the global public interest is being served. That's the rationale. It is not something that actually is only going to refuse shrinks. Quite on the contrary, it might be a way to overcome some objections with a process that has the legitimacy of a stronger majority in the board. That's the reason why.
So, Bertrand, let me see if I can break that down a little bit. If I'm understanding you correctly, you think there are instances where a higher threshold would be valuable to have for approval of a string, mm-hmm. Not just rejection of a string. And so let me ask you one very specific question first. You're not advocating that all strings should require a higher threshold, just some subset,
no.
Right?
No, you're absolutely correct.
Okay, so now if I'm correct on that, my next question for you is, how would we define the category of strings for which the category of strings that would require that higher threshold for approval, not just rejection? Is there you think that's possible?
Thank you for the question. It is the delicate point. One way could be that the recommendation of the DRSP or the advice from ALAC or the advice from the GAC could explicitly mention or not the triggering of this provision. For instance, you could have a GAC saying, or ALAC for that matter, but the GAC saying, this is the situation. There is a split position in the GAC regarding this. Some countries object and will likely block this, but that's all. And the board decides, normal majority, whatever. And there might be cases where there is significant concern in the GAC, so that GAC would say there are split positions within the GAC, but in that case, if the board takes a decision at a higher majority, then this is a natural way to overcome these concerns. So there would be the input would trigger the application of this thing. That's the only way I can see. I agree it's a delicate question, but it's probably a way to put some responsibility also on the DRSP, on the ALAC, and on the GAC regarding the input that they give to the board.
So let me request something of you, because it's still in my mind, at least. I don't know if it's true of others. It's not really clear how we would identify a situation that would require a higher threshold for approval. Could you possibly draft something up that you could send to the list in that regard? I know you verbally said some things, but it still doesn't seem to be defined enough that it would be easy to apply. And I think a lot of people would have concerns about it being too open, that it be a situation that could be used, maybe abused like that. I'm not suggesting that the GAC or the ALAC or anybody would really do that, but is that possible? Do you think you could write something up?
I think it's maybe just a little bit early. I'd like to get feedback on this idea that I'm just floating in answering your question. I think it would be good to get feedback, and I see that there are already some comments on the chat. Can we just think about it a little, if I was clear enough, and maybe there are problems of implementation. I do not dispute that, but it's something that I just try to introduce in answering your question. So maybe some feedback is needed on that before trying to formulate anything.
And if someone would like to raise their hand to share something, that would be fine. But let me go just a little bit different direction to see if we've got agreement in the other area. And that is there anybody that disagrees with the idea that to reject a string for which a recommendation 6 objection has been filed, that there should be a higher threshold of the board? Does anybody disagree with that idea? And Frank, I know your hand's up. Are you disagreeing, or is that on different subjects?
No, I'm not disagreeing, Chuck, and thank you for the opportunity. I'd just like to point out that if we're in a situation where the board is evenly split over whether a particular string should go into the root, then we probably have a controversial situation on our hands, no matter what. That you know, if there's an even split across the board, then obviously there are people on both sides of the argument, and it is a controversial string. Almost by definition, it's a controversial string. I just make a plea that I mean, Bertrand is trying to draw up a difficult definition, and I think it may be unnecessary. The very status of the board itself would define whether a string is controversial or not. So I guess what I'm saying is a supermajority would always be a useful thing. Thank you.
Always useful for all TLDs, or just TLDs for which there's an objection that has been filed with regard to Recommendation 6?
I guess I am talking about where there is an objection of any kind. If the board is split, then clearly there's some basis for the objection which appeals to more than a narrow majority or somebody exercising some sort of veto. The board is going to be, if there's no controversy, then you'd expect the board to be virtually unanimous under any circumstance. It's only what I'm saying is a split board means it's a controversial decision.
Yeah, right. So I think we have, and Richard, you're next, but I think we have, if I'm understanding correctly, 3 suggestions on the table. Number one, Aubrey's, I think, is that only if the board rejects a string for Recommendation 6 reasons should it require a higher threshold. I think Bertrand is saying that there's some subset of them that also should require a higher threshold to approve. And if I'm hearing you correctly, Frank, you're saying that for any string for which there's a Recommendation 6 objection filed, it should require a higher threshold, whether it be for approval or rejection. So one of the 3 of you, correct me if I captured those incorrectly. Okay. All right. So those are the things on the table right now. Go ahead. Who was that?
That was Lee Bertrand, but I think Frank is asking to speak. I'm not sure that's what Frank said, or maybe I misunderstood.
Frank, go ahead. Correct me if I captured that incorrectly.
Thank you. And I did leave my hand up by accident. I didn't mean to leave it there, but I think it's the opportunity anyway to clarify. What I'm saying is that in a situation where there's no controversy, you'd expect that the board will be pretty much unanimous. There may be the odd objection on the board, but there shouldn't be a problem getting a supermajority under non-controversial circumstances. What I'm saying is that a controversial one, and one which may get us out of this difficulty in terms of defining what is a difficult decision, what is a sensitive issue or not, is simply whether the board is split more or less evenly. So if we say a supermajority is required under all circumstances, it becomes self-defining as to what is controversial and what isn't. And that's almost irrespective of whether a particular objection has been made under one ground or another. But I'm happy to go with your third option, Chuck. I don't think we need to get into that. I'm happy with your third option of simply saying a supermajority under any condition where there has been objection raised under Recommendation 6. Because that encapsulates what I'm saying well enough. Thank you.
Oh, okay, good. Thanks for clarifying that. Now, I've got Richard and Bertrand in the queue. We're going to have to be really brief because we're out of time. But I would like, Aubrey, could you just take a minute or two and respond with regard to why you would oppose requiring a higher threshold for approval of strings? All strings that for which a Recommendation 6 objection has been filed?
Sure. Should I go before all the hands?
Yes, please.
Okay. Yeah, I think any time you've got any sort of controversial string, you're basically going to have the vote is going to be to reject it. I mean, it's always going to be framed in that there's going to be objection. This string should not happen. And so, therefore, the board will be stuck in a position of having to decide on whether to bar it or not. I think that there's no principle in the GNSO principles that said no string should be controversial. That was, you know, a fast-track IDN thing. But there is no such concept within the GNSO, the GPO principles, about controversial string. So I think to introduce that at this point is not a good thing to do. I think that if there is, remember, what we're trying to get rid of is those things that are not just controversial, but highly objectionable. And to prove that something's highly objectionable, it should be clear to everyone on the board, or close to everyone on the board, that this is highly objectionable. Thanks,
Aubrey. Let's go to Richard.
Yeah, thanks, Chuck. I think this, so I agree with what Frank said, and I agree with what Aubrey said to some extent. I think that there are, in my mind anyway, there are sort of two types of strings here, that there are those that are objectionable, or let's use the word sort of offensive. There are those that are offensive to some people, and other people sort of don't care. And then there are those that are offensive to some people, but in fact not at all offensive. In fact, they have value to other people. And so in my mind, you know, Frank gave the example of if something's 50-50 split on the board, it's sort of inherently controversial. In my mind, you know, maybe there's strings where some people actually find it offensive, but others see sort of some redeeming value from it that outweighs the fact that it gives offense to others. And so, you know, for me, the classic string in this example, I know we don't like to give examples too much here, but the classic example is gay, G-A-Y. I think that that's going to be a controversial string. I think some people are going to find it highly offensive, whereas other people are going to see that it's, in fact, a human right that needs to be protected. So they're sort of pushed in the other direction. So they're the sort of examples, to me, the ones that have some sort of redeeming value, they're the ones where I can see that that we might want to have a different threshold of voting in some way. So anyway, I wanted to put on the notion on the table that I think that there are certainly those that are offensive, or not offensive, but there are those that are sort of in both camps. They're offensive to some, but others it's important that we have these strings in the root.
Okay. Thank you, Richard.
Chuck Markov, if I can just come in briefly. I know we're running out of time, but I'm very sympathetic to that. Thanks. Yeah, I'm very sympathetic to that last point. The very fact that a string is controversial should not be the determinant on whether it's approved or not, because the aspects of it may be very complex, and you know, we need to be objective about this process. And I'll think further about what Frank was saying, but I'm instinctively nervous about a deduction flowing from the fact that the board is split, or there's a sort of inherent turbulent controversy about a proposal. The processes need to be very objective and provide absolute clarity as to the decisions taken which affect the fate of a proposal. Thanks.
So, I may be way off on this, so please tell me if I am. But does that mean that you lean more towards Aubrey's suggestion that only a high threshold should be required for rejecting a string that has a Recommendation 6 dispute file?
Yes, in answer to that question, yes, that is my feeling. I'm always, again, uncomfortable about terms like high threshold, because how do you actually define what a threshold is? And, you know, if something's slightly under, is that treating something unfairly? If it's, you know, so defining a threshold is a problem. But my instinct is to go for that higher, higher level of sureness. I don't know. I'm sort of working with words a bit here. But yes, in answer to your question, yes.
Thank you. And Bertrand, you have 1 minute.
Yeah. No, very, very quickly. I think this discussion helps me clarify one thing. I think we are making just one mistake in discussing this, because, Chuck, you keep referring to cases where an objection has been filed. As a matter of fact, the determining factor is what is the result of the DRSP or the input from GAC and ALAC regarding that string. In other words, if an objection is filed and the DRSP says we didn't see any international law principle that was justifying an objection, or we end up deciding that the string is okay in general terms, then of course there is no need for a supermajority. If, on the contrary, the DRSP says, or if, on the contrary, the board wants to object or not approve something that the DRSP has said causes no problem, a supermajority is certainly required, and I think a lot of people in this group would even think that if the DRSP says there's no problem, board should not be vetoing the string at all. The case that I'm trying to address is the situation where the DRSP says the string is really raising a problem, and the board wants to decide to put it in. I think it is overruling the DRSP in a positive sense because of larger concerns or interests, and maybe here we might need a supermajority. The question is, what do we do when the situation is that the DRSP gives an answer that is somewhere in between, that says there are no absolute international objections, but there are very significant national objections based on law in a relatively broad manner or whatever, and the board has to take the decision of whether it decides yes or no. And here, the question may require a supermajority, maybe in one way or the other. So I think we should focus, and I finished with this here, we'll think about it later. It's not about whether an objection is being filed. It's for overruling in one direction or the other the result of the DRSP, so that there is some clear message from the board, either versus the DRSP or versus GAC advice that is in between, that would say, yes, we put it in. Or if, for instance, the GAC strongly objects to this, maybe a supermajority in the board would be needed to overcome a GAC objection, for instance. But it's the outcome of the advice being given to the GAC by the DRSP, the GAC, or ALAC that would trigger a supermajority, not the fact that something has been filed. Because if the DRSP or the GAC say, we have no problem with that string, of course there's no need for a supermajority. So I think it's
okay.
A decision.
Okay.
by the way, I think you're heading in the direction of doing that task that I asked you that you postponed, right? I think that was very helpful, and I accept the correction. I think you're right. It shouldn't be whether a dispute is filed, but that was well said. So thank you very much. Now, here's what we're gonna have to pick this up tomorrow. We won't spend a lot of time on it tomorrow, but maybe we can zero it down. I think, Marika, what we have is that, at least in this group today, I don't think there's anybody that objects to having a higher board threshold in cases where a string is rejected for a Recommendation 6 issue, but we still have to work on the other side a little bit more. Now, if I stated that wrong very quickly, let me know that. Otherwise, Marika's going to put it out and get feedback from those that aren't on the call. So, while you're thinking, and raise your hand if you disagree with that, tomorrow what we're going to do is we're going to, first of all, have a presentation by one of the legal experts that I can use in developing the implementation plan, the dispute process, and so forth, and there will be a Q&A after that. Once we've covered that, then we're going to spend a little bit of time on the report that we have to produce and deliver a week from today. It will just be Margie is at my request, is developing the kind of the template, the basic information that hopefully will be relatively non-controversial. And then we will we'll spend a little bit of time on that. We obviously got a long ways to go on that, but if we can at least have a straw man in place with the basic structure, the template for doing that, then as we agree on recommendations during this week, we can fit those into there relatively easily. Now, last thing, I think we're going to need another call besides tomorrow this week to get our work done. So I have asked Glenn to send out another doodle poll for Wednesday and or Thursday in that regard. So please be looking for that. And I apologize for so many meetings, but I don't know how else we can get this done or at least, you know, give a helpful report without doing that. So please be expecting that. Now, before I adjourn, is there anything I've missed, Cheryl or Frank?
I just popped in my great job, let's keep it up message.
Okay, thanks. As you can tell, I haven't even tried to keep up in the chat because trying to keep up and manage everything else challenges my mind enough. So
that's why you need three of us, mate.
That's right. Thank you. I appreciate that, Frank.
I'm happy to echo that.
Okay, my compliments for really cooperative work. Be thinking about this on the board threshold. We'll try and spend 10-15 minutes on that tomorrow. I'm going to try to make the call tomorrow. I think I will. It'll probably be in the same setting I'm in today. So we'll see how that goes. And if not, Cheryl will pick up for me in that regard.
Frank and I will tag team it, but your setting has been fine. So if you think there's background noise, believe me, we didn't hear any of it.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, thanks, everybody. Sorry for running over. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks, everyone, especially those on your vacation day. Bye.